Decibels. Principles. Principles. Principles.
This is Chroma Radio, a visual arts podcast based in Toronto. What is the relationship between art and science today? Just look at microchips, multi-touch screens, and solar panels. Objects that were once distant wet dreams of science fiction writers are now everyday and ubiquitous. Indeed, technology has informed our everyday lives and has led to innovative approaches to art. For this episode, we interview Peter Todd on physics, programming, and art. Peter Todd is a multidisciplinary and multi-talented artist, or as he insists, unfortunately, former artist, who was also an electronics engineer and student of physics. We will query him on his past artworks, his approach to art as a set of rules, and why technology continues to be so relevant today. The track you are hearing is by Serge and Benoit, called Principles. Pretty apt for this episode. And so we move on to Peter Todd. I begin with an artist statement that he has written in the past.
In the sciences, there is a recurring theme of simplification, where successive layers of theory are refined until they are as simple as possible, while still describing reality accurately. My artwork is roughly this process in reverse, taking simple rules and expanding them through programming and electronics back into complex realities. So what kind of god are you?
The sort of one enabled by modern technology. Well, it's like, I mean, suppose you were a physicist, and we'll make it 300 years ago, so we don't need, say, CERN to get anything interesting done. So we'll put you in, say, Newton's time, and you'll go have a ball, and you'll be trying to reason about the things that this ball can do. And, you know, you might take the ball and you'll drop it, or roll it down an incline, and, you know, you start timing it and trying to get an idea of, well, what's really going on? I mean, everyone knows that, you know, things fall, but why? And you go through the whole process and you come up with some rules, and that's doing physics. You're collecting data, mm-hmm. and you're coming up with rules to describe the data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I was always doing in my artwork was exact opposite of that, in that I came up with rules and then looked at where the rules would go.
So you invented rules.
Yes, exactly. Like, in, you know, those rules, they can be all sorts of things, but, you know, take, for instance, my 64-bit counter that I did, which the so-called rule behind the piece is it's a counter. It counts, and it counts upwards. And that was the piece. Now, the way I turned it into a reality was, you know, and using my sort of terminology for taking these rules and creating a reality of it, is I created a physical piece. It would sit on a wall, and every single bit of that 64-bit counter was represented by an LED, and it would just sit there counting all day long.
Mm-hmm.
The key thing being that it was counting at about 60 million times per second. So in terms of the visual experience, the vast majority of the individual bits or digits of the counter, you just can't see what they're doing at all. They're just a complete blur. And then gradually it slows down, or at least the counting speed, you know, slows down to the point where you can see it. And by the time it rolls over, a few centuries will have passed.
Yes, right? We'll post images of this piece, but it begins with nanoseconds.
Yeah.
like the smallest unit of time, the conceivably smallest unit of time, and it moves towards centuries, right? Yeah. And it's not like a clock where there is regular motions. It seems to be aberrant and irregular.
You can take the example of math, where people have this debate over, is math discovered or is math invented? And the reason why they have this debate is math is fundamentally about rules. And the rules that can be proven are, of course, you know, I mean, I shouldn't say of course, but they are a function of the structure of logic. But there's this big catch, which is that, well, the number of rules that we would, for instance, teach you in university, it's, of course, vastly smaller than the potential number of rules out there. So why pick those ones to teach? Well, that's because they're right. But why are they right? Because they seem, you know, quote-unquote useful or beautiful, and suddenly get all this arbitrary sense of selection, you know, sense of, I mean, really, anthropomorphism. You know, this is the right set of rules. But math itself, of course, can't tell you what set of rules are right or wrong. Fundamentally, there
math
is
doesn't
some...
care.
Yeah, you'd say math doesn't care, but math can't care. Yeah. It's just rules.
Yeah. And in that same way, then, you construct an object beginning with a set of rules that you then program into a computer, and the computer will execute these rules, and you have no control over how the computer executes it, correct?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And why do you enjoy this process?
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, I guess I could, of course, ask the other question, you know. Suppose you were a painter and creating paintings. Well, you're really doing the same thing too. It might be less focused on the creation of the rules themselves, but, you know, take a surrealistic painting. We'll do the standard example of, you know, something with a bunch of clocks melting. Well, all right, so you're violating notions of what reality is, but you still have a set of rules that are fundamentally embedded into the piece. You know, you have notions of gravity. When a clock melts, it kind of falls downwards. You're not just making stuff up. You're making stuff up, but then applying this framework that you made up to go create a reality. Now, because you're a painter, you don't have a computer to make all the rules do their thing for you, so you end up envisioning this and applying it to canvas and so on. But the only difference between them and me is I don't have to do any of that stuff, because the computer can do it for me.
Yep. Yep. And yeah, in that basic sense, there is no difference. The act of creation is the same. It reminds me of a quote Picasso said, something Picasso said, that art is a lie that tells the truth.
Yeah.
And for you, rules, I mean, math does not concern itself with lies, right? So math operates by taking things as a matter of faith in a strange way, right? Like,
Well, rules don't have faith.
Okay, you're right. Maybe I'm making it too religious, but an axiom, a mathematical axiom, when we say something's axiomatic, we cannot question it. Right?
Exactly.
And that is a rule. And through that rule, people are able to construct realities or hypothesize something. Hypothesize,
yeah.
Right? Basically, people are able to move on from a starting point.
Well,
right?
And maybe to explain a little more clearly, I mean, you got to remember that when a mathematician talks about an axiom, they're using this very specific meaning, which is that an axiom is something that you do not question the truth of. And fundamentally, to reason about systems, you have to have axioms. You know, if you have something as simple as, well, how do you count? The very rule that 1 plus 1 equals 2 is an axiom. Mm-hmm. Or, if that isn't an axiom, you're going to go pick another axiom that just proves that in a different way. Fundamentally, you have to go pick some axioms to then go down that process. Otherwise, you know where to start.
And these axioms are like the way people count, right? As your example, this convention became a convention through history, correct?
Well,
or is it just because they're right? Like that's when social yeah. scientists like start to question hard scientists, like is this cultural? Is the fact that certain things are being studied in math departments and not others cultural? Do you think these questions are valid?
Well, I think in a very theoretical sense they are, but coming from a so-called practical sense, I like to always ask the question, well, suppose we one day go meet some aliens out in space. What's their system of math going to look like? I'll guarantee you it's going to have counting. I'll guarantee you it's going to have the notion of pi. It's going to have all these things that we have, well, if you're of the mind that we invented them, things that we've invented, yet somehow this group of aliens will come up with the exact same thing. Sounds much more me like we're discovering stuff. But, you know, it does kind of have a tinge of hypothetical debate to it. You can argue it that you're inventing stuff. What it kind of just keeps going. Whereas I'm kind of lucky in the way I create my art because it can be seen as very sort of a creation because I'm just picking up these rules and then trying to go make a piece of art out of it. But just as equally, and I mean, I thought it's fair to say that I saw this a lot myself. At OCAD, the school that I went to, people end up going down the same path multiple times. And you could kind of say, well, really, the specifics of the artwork they create might be different in subtle ways. But say, for example, you have a switch, and you can stand on the switch, and it'll trigger something. You're probably going to end up making the same sort of foot switch triggered art as a bunch of other people have.
Yeah, there are internal limitations to whatever medium you choose.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
But these limitations are the conditions of creation, right?
Yeah. And what conditions are you under?
And I mean, because you chose what Dali didn't have the luxury or the ability to choose, which is a computer able to do infinite tasks. Infinite simple tasks, maybe, but it's still a computer.
But how many interesting simple tasks are there? Probably not that many.
Maybe just counting and...
Well, yeah. This is kind of the straitjacket of my style of work. You know, you get led down paths. Like one good example is for my thesis work, I did a lot of stuff exploring rules, rules purely as programming exercises. One simple example was something I did early on, which was... I was playing with the rules of erosion, and
Can you describe that piece?
Well, I don't really think I can even call it a piece, of course. It was an experiment.
Okay.
But it was very simple. It was a bit of computer code that had this simple concept of water and sand. And the idea is if you dropped water on sand, the water would flow downhill, and while it flowed downhill, it would carry away sand. And in terms of computer code, that ends up being, you know, I think maybe 100 lines worth of instructions to computer of doing one thing and doing another thing. Mm-hmm. And what do you know? You do this, you run it. It looks just like some kid went out to a sandhill and put a hose on it.
That's amazing.
Same rules.
That sounds extremely difficult, though.
But it's so simple.
But your ability to be simple is because of your eloquence in programming language, right? Like the ability to synthesize rules and translate them into something the computer could understand and then have it manifest in the computer screen like it does in the physical world. That's amazing.
Well, I sort of take the view that I can't really call what I actually did technically there very amazing, as it is a very simple thing, and there are literally millions of programmers out there who could have done exactly what I did. I was just kind of unusual in taking it as an artwork rather than taking it as, say,
animation.
Yeah, for a first-year computer science project to, you know, play around with something.
So how is that? How can you tease that difference out more?
Well, in some ways, no.
Okay.
As if that first-year computer science student approached it as a piece of art, they're not really doing anything different than what I did. I just did it from a very different angle, having gone through an art school, having gone through all this stuff. And it's, again, it's sort of no different than your carpenter versus your artist working with wood. They may end up doing the exact same task, but who's approaching it from the point of view of art and taking with it all that sort of cultural context?
Can you describe your art in two sentences?
This is going to be hard. Well, it's always been about making models. And then the second aspect after you've made the model is go create it in some sort of physical reality. I mean, a good example was my thesis project, which was really about exploring traffic and kind of the underlying rules behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's some very simple things from, for instance, how cars follow one another, you know, to what end up kind of being the sort of overall theme of my thesis, for my final thesis work, which was something called demographic gravitation.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind it is sort of to take the observation that populations tend to cluster and come up with a model that sort of tried to describe it. And back in the 50s, the guy who, came up with this term, he decided to go take Newton's laws of gravitation and apply that to demographics and population densities as though people's attraction towards one another, you know, was akin to how gravity works. So in the Newton's law of gravitation, it's a very simple rule, which is that if you have two objects, they attract each other. And by attract, it is a very specific meaning of they apply force to each other based on the distance between them squared and the ratio of the two masses. Now, if you take this and apply it to human populations, well, for every single human in an area where they decide to live, they will apply a force to each other, trying to encourage them to live closer to each other. Now, this is only an approximation of what people really do, but, you know, you can make the argument that, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. So I went and took that rule and did sort of two things. I'd have a stage where the populations would try to combine and achieve a sort of distribution. And then I also had a stage where they would go build road networks between each other.
So it's, in my brain, what it's making me imagine, it's as imaginative or more imaginative than financial instruments. Like, it sounds just as arbitrary, which is why it is art, but sometimes it could turn into the debt crisis, right?
But remember, financial instruments are designed to achieve very specific goals.
This is true. And art is designed to achieve
very specific goals
as well. Yeah. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, for my art, in my case, I was really exploring a set of rules. And, you know, for this demographic gravitation thing, by the time I was done, it would go basically spit out images that look suspiciously, though, they were satellite images. As though you were looking out, say, you know, a plane window or something, looking at the grid of streetlights under you. Now, there would be some differences, too, because my program had no notion of straight lines. Although then again, I mean, if you'd say grown up in London.
Or Paris.
London's a great example because it evolved over time. Mm-hmm. And its whole street network is total chaos.
But Paris is concentric circles.
Exactly. Paris was designed.
Yeah. You're right. London has more. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the approach I was taking. But you go look at, say, economic rules like debt instruments. I mean, Something people don't understand is, for all we like to say about the free market, the reality is where the free market operates, that is, stock markets and other financial structures, they have more rules about them than nearly any other system in human practice.
So the financial markets have their own version of axioms.
Yeah.
And yeah. they're probably juridical.
Well, they evolve based on what the actors in the financial market want. But the key thing to remember about that is what happens is it has very specific notions of fairness. Because, you know, a good example is a stock in general. Well, if you want to go have a publicly traded corporation, you have to tell your investors a lot. And because your investors can be the public, in practice, you have to go tell the public a lot. And that's why companies have quarterly reports. That's why they are audited. That's why you have this enormous, enormous regulatory framework trying to go and catch financial criminals, trying to go and ensure people stay honest, that if something goes bad to a company, they will immediately admit it.
But that's because they are accountable to a public stakeholder.
Exactly. And people don't understand how deep this accountability works. You know, it's not the Wild West out there. If anything, it's farther from the Wild West than almost any other system in human existence, precisely because investors lose money if people are dishonest. You know, it's why we call it financial crime. And those rules all evolve over time to continually get a better regulatory system that for the stakeholders, that is, namely large institutional investors. I mean, a good example is, for instance, Ontario. The group that holds the largest amount of stock in Ontario is the teachers' pension plan.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. They have more influence on the Ontario stock market than any other entity.
Why is that?
Well, there are a lot of teachers out there, and all their retirement savings are invested in the Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan Fund.
That makes sense, then. So,
you know, it's who has the most money.
When popular conceptions of stockbrokers are they're crocodiles who try to swindle money out of a system that is corrupt and decrepit, right? I mean, that's like
that's the caricature
of how people think about it, right? And these people are they're not only well educated, they're not only well versed in financial rules, they also hire mathematicians and physicists.
Yeah.
They try to justify their actions through models that have some approximation of being reasonable or convincing, right?
But you kind of have to go back to, well, what is the economy anyway? I mean, fundamentally, why do you even have money? And it all comes down to, well, how do you gather information on what things are worth? Heck, what is what things are worth? It's a really tough question to go answer.
Yeah.
And what you see in Western economies is things aren't always priced correctly. But suppose that you live in a communist country. And of course, historically, there are tons of examples of this. Well, how do you price things? And honestly, they didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
And the really strange thing about the history of it is that the countries that did best were the ones that had free market economies before. And if you look at the history of communism, the countries that did have free market economies, when they switched to communism, generally they would go, and of course, have their own idea of what a currency is, even in communism. But very importantly, they would continue to use old pricing. And that old pricing is really information about what things cost to make, how much things should cost, how do you allocate stuff. It's fundamentally, I mean, pricing is allocation of resources. You know, it's an incredibly complex thing. Like,
For it's instance, also very, it's very simple as well, right?
I mean, it seems simple when you have an economy.
It's just as simple as counting, right? Like the way that you were talking about counting.
But there's
earlier.
A lot of counting involved.
But it's like, it's a question of value, which relates to the question of a programmer approaching his work as design or animation versus you approaching programming as art. I mean, it's there are connections between that and between the way human beings try to understand how things are made and how things are priced and how much things cost and how they account for that in their everyday lives. So all of those systems seem to be very simple facts of human existence that have been either managed efficiently by governments or exploited to maintain a certain power balance.
But here's kind of an interesting idea. Problem with seemingly simple systems is it can have very complex results. And
Like how?
Well, have you ever heard of the Mandelbrot fractal?
No.
Well, it's this very simple rule. If I remember, it's equation, I think, you know, well, essentially something is equal to, in the complex domain, you know, a bunch of iterated multiplications. And what it's really saying is, well, if you run this equation over and over again, the number of times that the equation can run before it reaches zero will either extend to infinity, or it will reach zero in a given number of times. In that pattern of how fast it reaches zero, if you plot it in a two-dimensional plane, it's this incredibly complex object that has an infinite amount of detail in it. So if you try to plot a very small section of it, it has just as much detail as if you tried to plot the whole thing in one go.
That's amazing.
It's sort of how it's, it's called a fractal. It's an object with an infinite amount of detail. But going back to your economy thing, well, let's suppose you were the USSR in around maybe, you know, early 1980s, and you're finally getting to the point where you can start to build personal computers. How much should you charge for them? And you just keep drilling down detail after detail.
Yeah.
And it's seemingly never ending. I mean, these days, a PC is probably, you know, to create a computer probably involves in the region of, say, 10,000 different companies, if not more. It's only really feasible to figure this out if you have an entire economy system working and generating prices.
So 10,000 companies are needed to make one.
I'm just guessing, but it's a reasonable guess.
It goes through a lot of hands.
It's in the thousands.
Yeah,
probably tens of thousands.
And what's interesting is that if we compare Macs to PCs, right? I know everybody's going to hate this, and I will expose my biases, but part of Mac selling a selling point of a Mac product is how it feels in your hands, right? And how it's basically how it's made. But then you have how it's made externally. You have no real clue about what's going on inside. And what's going on inside could be an analogy to the complexity of the economy that we're in.
Yeah.
And how processing plants in Bangladesh, millions of workers in China, all of these factors.
And don't forget, most of them are actually in the States too.
Yeah.
Usually they get made in the States, it gets shipped off to some foreign country where they get assembled, then it gets shipped back, or maybe through a couple more people. It all depends, but it's this incredibly complex distribution chain.
Yeah, well, if you think about that and the car industry, it's probably these huge industries that require... I mean, why do you think that it has to be this complex? Why can't they just make it all in one place?
Technology is complex. You know, I love how if you look at Intel's roadmap for where computers are going, or to be exact, where are computer chips going, their roadmap, at the end of the roadmap in, I think it's 2015 or 2016, when they have no plans for what they're going to do to make computers faster beyond that.
It's 4 years from now.
I know, it's very soon.
Yeah.
The transistors they're going to be building by that point are about 1,000 atoms wide.
You have to explain that.
Well, you know, there are transistors are, of course, made out of silicon atoms. Problem is the width of the transistors is getting to the point where it's approaching the same scale as the atoms themselves. And once you get to that point, I mean, an atom's indivisible. Then what do you do? Nobody knows.
So are you saying...
Well, what I'm really
It's not a technological problem. It's not even a mathematical problem. It's something about the need to be faster.
Well, need to be precise. And what I'm saying is that, well, okay, so that seems simple. But how do you actually achieve that? It's this gigantic framework of companies and production processes and all this. It just keeps on adding up. Suppose that you're trying to build solar power plants. Well, what drives how much energy you can get from the sun? The problem is the amount of energy falling on a given, you know, 1 square meter is fixed. There is not more energy to get. Mm-hmm. And that's why solar power, the efficiencies you see from the cells aren't really that much different than they were 20 years ago. I think now
there's a threshold.
Well, there's a maximum. You know, you only get, by the time it hits the ground, depending on where you live, of course, you know, but say like 500 watts per square meter. You cannot get better than that. The energy just doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. No matter how hard you try, you will never get better than that. You can't.
When people think of the sun, they think it's infinite, right?
Yeah.
But they forget about square footage.
Yeah.
I mean, and the fact that the energy has to land onto a surface, the solar cell, and has to be transformed into energy. So...
There are limitations.
Like, yeah, these limitations are why people get paid a lot of money to do what they do and to make it easy for the consumer to live or to use this technology. Like, well, can you imagine we'll be getting they are already selling solar cells in Home Depot, right? You could.
And they don't make very much sense.
Why not?
Well, I think an even simpler example I can give is let's suppose you're going to make a wind turbine. And your wind turbine is going to be a full-scale one. Mm-hmm. And this is a good thing to do because the higher up your turbine is, the smoother and faster the wind is because it's farther from the Earth's surface, which slows down the wind. Mm-hmm. So you should go make a big one. But fundamentally, you have to put energy into creating your wind turbine. And I remember I went and did the math on this a while back, and I asked myself, well, all right, how many, you know, tons of steel are in a wind turbine? Well, what do you know? It scales towards how big it is. Now, the bigger it is, the more energy you get per ton of steel, but you're still going to have to put some energy into making it.
Yes. It's a lot like the Prius.
Well, suppose that you want a ton of steel. Well, what do you need to make your ton of steel? Right, you're going to melt it because you want to form it into a shape that...
You need energy to make the steel.
And that energy to make the steel, well, the lower bound on how much is the lower bound of energy required to melt the steel. You can't get lower than that. And what do you know? If you do the math out for the best wind turbines we've made, well, their energy payback time, as in how many years do you have to run them before they generate enough energy to melt the steel used to require them, is on the order of, you know, 3 years.
That's not that bad. I was expecting it to be worse. Well, but it's still pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. You know, let's suppose you're trying to make an economy out of this.
Yeah. It isn't, yeah.
Your wind turbines better last more than 3 years. You know, if you can make them last 20 years, maybe you can make this feasible, but it's a really dangerous game to be playing. You know, now, Let's compare this to, say, oil extraction. When Saudi Arabia first started drilling their wells, the oil was under pressure. So you'd put a hole in the earth, you'd put some casing down there, put a pipe in, and the oil would just come out. You know, your ratio of energy put in versus energy out was on the order of, say, 100 to 1, 200 to 1. Yeah. It was so
huge
high.
Profit.
You couldn't lose.
Yeah.
But with renewable energy, we're getting really, really close to the point where you don't get money back from it. You don't get energy back from it. And that's dangerous.
But that's when it becomes an ethical issue. That's when it becomes supplanted by different kinds of understanding, norms, visions of value, right? Like, that's when tree huggers are like, this is better. I'll have a house running.
There are externalities,
yeah,
you know, in your alternatives. I mean, yeah, we should be paying for the cost to others of the CO2 we put in the atmosphere, but we don't. But fundamentally, let's suppose that tomorrow we implemented carbon taxes that truly captured that value. The problem is if it turns out that your wind turbines as a whole can't actually create more energy than they use, because after all, the steel isn't the only thing going into it. There's a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But if that ratio isn't very good, well, what's going to happen to the price of energy? Well, it'll go through a set of cycles where first it becomes
payback of the initial investment.
At first it would become more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And then investors in the market would realize, well, we didn't make it expensive enough. So it'd become more expensive. And gradually the information as to, well, how much does energy cost would tend towards infinity, because there is no price at which you can make it pay back. Under this, you know, scenario where you say, all right, we're going to go and, you know, increase CO2 taxes to the point where everyone stops doing it. But it just might not be possible. There's no way of getting around that. You know, wind turbines, it seems like, all right, maybe we can make this work. But a lot of people argue, say, corn ethanol in the States is actually energy negative because of all the energy put into farming it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you had a market economy really running, it would notice this and the prices would just go to infinity. I mean, it truly can't work. And if it truly can't work, well, tough. There's just nothing you can do about it. I don't know, start growing your sugar in Brazil to make ethanol or something. You know, do it somewhere where it's cheaper.
Or, to be exact,
more energy positive.
Consume less.
Right, but that becomes its own problems. If you just say consume less,
businesses will close.
Well, no, it's even more worrying than that. Going back to my computer chips thing, well, if the whole economy can support one chip fab, and the chip fabs currently are just at the point where renewable energy, because after all, people don't realize this, but a lot of the renewable energy solutions that do work are really heavily dependent on computing and also power electronics, which is heavily dependent on chip fabs.
Mm-hmm.
If your economy can't support a chip fab, you're probably screwed. And you cannot get renewable energy to work because you can't support your chip fabs. So you kind of have to get over this threshold. And by consuming less, you can end up getting under that threshold in that, well, now you say, all right, we're not going to waste energy on unnecessary things like, you know, personal computers. Well,
yeah.
But if you don't have that, your chip industry is going to close up and the R&D won't go into it. You know, my approach to art is only possible. My approach to art is only possible assuming that you have technological infrastructure, assuming you've got all this great stuff. You know, for it to exist even really 50 years ago was nowhere near as possible, because of course computers didn't exist cheaply. They didn't exist accessibly. So yeah, it's completely dependent on it. And at the same time, in terms of where it innovates, is also a function of the existence of computers. People doing the sort of art that I do. Well, 50 years from now, assuming everything kind of stays the same, there wouldn't be interesting art being done the way I'm doing because you would have explored the possible space of stuff to do.
And that possible space is finite.
Yeah, very finite.
Would you...
Or at least the interesting part of it is finite.
Would you agree with the idea that in the rise of a new technology, like the printing press, where things could be are reproducible faster than transcribing manuscripts by hand, or in the same way, the invention of consumer computers and the iPad and all of these things, that art dies?
No, I think in the invention of that, art has this enormous new space of possibilities, and that's where you see new art.
Do you think it takes time before it's merely just tinkering with a new technology, reveling in it, in how wonderful it is and how fascinating it is, and then after like even 40 years, only then will it be about about art and not about the technological scaffolding?
Now, I take the exact opposite view. I think what happens is you get a stage of course tinkering as you explore stuff, and then tinkering can lead to creating quite interesting work, but eventually you will run out of new stuff to do. And a great example is looking at the history of paintings. Precisely because paintings have been around so long that you can look at the history of paintings.
Yes.
And, you know, I remember even like my first year of art history thinking to myself, well, what's really different about the religious iconography paintings of, you know, early medieval era versus later? Well, they came up with a bunch of new technology, such as perspective. You know, perspective is a technology.
How so?
It's a technology in the sense that new advances in math are technology.
It's technology in the sense that what was once flat is now three-dimensional.
Yeah. You know, technology doesn't have to actually be a physical thing. Usually at least many times in history, what has enabled technology has been advances in math followed by advancements in physics. Perspective is just a very unique example where the application seems so immediate that there was no thing to invent other than discovering the rules behind it.
Yeah, and it's also visual.
Yeah, it's not so easy to
get.
It's
not a it's a visual manifestation, an image of a mathematical model.
Yeah, and in a very direct way.
And when a child looks at it, they can say, that's a building.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why it's different.
Yeah. It's not like the steam engine in that there was an artifact to go show what we had gone and explored. It is, and it's directly applied. And again, having said that, well, perspective was a technological advancement. It created a whole bunch of new art. But had we stuck around in castles for another couple hundred years, art historians would probably have gone and talked about the great pieces of a few different centuries. But they wouldn't go and say, well, there's a million different evolutions to all this. Things would have stagnated and there would be a bunch of stuff that looked the same.
So it reaches like a plateau.
Yeah, it reaches a plateau as the space is being explored. There are only so many different interesting things you can do with, you know, standard head and shoulders shots, standard building shots, yeah. Things that you do with perspective, you know, in the sort of Renaissance way. I mean, people creating art that looks like that aren't hailed as being revolutionary now. Because after all, they aren't. They're just creating more stuff that follow the same set of rules.
From 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
New technology enables different rules.
New technology enables different rules. But I wonder if it's a question of speed, right? If we compare the objects that human, technological objects, or technologies that humans have invented, like computers and the internet and mass communication, compare that with the pace of cultural innovations, right? Like the fact that terrorism exists, the fact that fundamentalism still continues to exist, that there are white supremacists, you know, that there's a Bible Belt, right? These things presumably slow things down. And does that mean then that we are unable to keep up with what we have created?
Well, I think you could go look at something like, say, the Bible Belt in terrorism and so on as, well, why would they go away?
Good point. They've been around for much longer.
It's something coming out of, you know, the way humans work. And terrorism is still a strategy that has appealed to people. You know, why would that appeal go away? You still have people who feel that they're not a part of society. In the case of the Bible Belt, you still have people who have that innate feeling of wanting to be religious. And, you know, that's programmed into our brains probably. So why would it go away? You know, technology just changes the way that things exhibit itself. Not necessarily, it doesn't change the fundamental natures of who people are.
But then math, which exceeds human existence, like it's a lot like your art, right? It comes from a set of rules that human beings may have invented or discovered.
Yeah.
And then it becomes its own animal. That's what art is, right? That's also in a way what math is.
But I would say that art, though, is very different, though, in that the experience of art is so dependent on the viewer. For art to have meaning, there must be a viewer who assigns meaning to it.
You don't think that there are people who make art that nobody will ever see?
Well, they're called mathematicians. I mean, you could kind of say, well, if you want to go look for something that is very pure in having meaning on its own, I think you do get forced back into math or physics. Math, because you're finding systems that exist in the nature of what systems can be itself. And we're making this assumption here that somehow you're going to say that some systems are more interesting than others. I mean, the great example being, well, everyone's heard of, you know, geometry's idea that the Euclidean idea that no two parallel lines ever intersect. Well, that's an axiom.
But when, this might be too popular, like a popular question,
yeah,
right? But like, when an axiom, or when math or physics, let's say Stephen Hawking, like people like that, when they try to explain these things, they try to explain them in ways that are relevant to our daily existence, or they try to appeal to the
kernel.
That's
how they explain it to us.
Ah, not to each other.
Yeah. And to each other, what do? They look at math, and they find systems in math that seem very close to the systems they're describing, as close as possible. And they'll say, all right, let's go make the assumption that the physical system I'm studying follows the same rules as a mathematical system. And they come up with a set of rules written in math that now apply to the physical system. And you can ask yourself, well, why does this work? Well, the physical system follows rules too. Now, they might not be precisely the same rules as the mathematical system, but they're probably close. An example being, well, in our physical reality, for the most part, parallel lines do not intersect. This isn't quite true, because the force of gravity turns out actually does warp the structure of reality, but doesn't warp it by very much. So Euclidean applied to our reality is nearly correct, if not 100% correct.
And sometimes nearly correct is enough.
It's more than good enough if I'm building a trench bucket. In fact, it's good enough if I want to go to the moon. You know, Euclidean geometry and Newtonian physics is pretty much good enough to get man to the moon. And the parts where it isn't good enough, well, there are other effects that are going to be bigger in magnitude than that anyway, so you don't really have to worry about it.
It reminds me of a sculptor, like it invokes an image of a sculptor gluing two pieces of plastic together, and it might not be a perfect edge, but if it approximates it,
yeah,
it will become a box.
Yeah,
and like that idea of I'm only bringing that up because I see parallels between art, the motivations behind the creation of art and the motivations behind the exploration of axioms in physics and in math, yeah. Right? Because it's the idea that maybe it's true, right?
Yeah.
But we kind of have to assume some parts are true so that we can move on to the next part. Just as the sculptor will make sure this edge is straight,
yeah,
so that he could move on to the next piece. The best novelists, for me at least, are a lot of them are in sci-fi.
Sci-fi is full of rules.
Yep, it's like the standard, the suspension of disbelief is exactly why it seems so true, right? Doomsday, like all of these apocalyptic visions, Blade Runner, like things like that, are just seem so plausible
because they have a very consistent model to them,
and that consistency is applied all throughout the movie or the novel, and that's why it works. It's just
it creates a world that you look into.
Yeah.
Now I think a lot of modernist stuff is kind of interesting in that aspect, though.
Modernist what?
Well, I'm actually thinking of stuff like the really stripped down modernist aesthetic that everyone knows of.
Okay.
You know, let's go take your modernist chair and it'll have, you know, a couple different load bearing elements and then that's it. And at one level, it's a very succinct narrative of a very small set of rules.
You're thinking of the Bauhaus.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were very good at creating things that were so obvious in how they worked, so obvious in how forces moved through the piece.
But with the reaction of people at the time of the Bauhaus, right? Seamless objects, lighter telephones, different materials, the bicycle chair, like all of these things. A lot of people didn't like it. They thought it was ugly, right? Because it didn't have curves or
ornament. It didn't have the rules they expected.
Yeah, ornamentation.
Ornamentation is this very interesting set of rules. Because everyone has this mental model of what Victorian looks like.
Yeah.
And it's this very specific set of rules for ornamentation. Everyone knows what Greek looks like.
Yep.
And we can go even classify. What sort of columns do they have?
Yep.
The very fact that you can classify them says that they're about rules.
Yep.
And they speak to us because our brain looks at that and it starts classifying it and starts developing this narrative about it.
Yep. And once modernists have tried to reorient it and also in the wake of industrial revolution and mass production, having the ability to make a lot of it.
Yeah.
Right? And eventually the ability to make it cheaper, then it overruns the stuff with all the ornamentation, and that stuff becomes luxury or vintage. Like, it's very interesting, right?
I think this is an interesting idea because let's suppose that you were living before the time of industrialization. You wouldn't be exposed to objects that don't have history to them. Now that we, though, do live in a situation where industrialization exists, We have tons of objects with no history. You know, take your average Apple iBrick. Your average Apple iBrick is going to have rounded corners. It's going to have a bunch of flat surfaces, and it's going to have some chrome on it. And at one level, yes, this has this great modernist aesthetic to it. But I think for many people it fails. Because when you pick one up, once you get past this, that aesthetic and all the symbology to it, there really is nothing more to it.
It's supposed to disappear. It's supposed to make you function.
And it's funny looking at the iPhone because it does disappear when you use it. You don't look at it. You look at the screen and all that other stuff. And as an object, it does work in that sense because it doesn't need to be there. But if you had, say, Steve Jobs go and start designing buildings, they wouldn't look like iPhones at all. Because he's smart enough to realize that if you completely took all that narrative away, it wouldn't work. Why do people go like all these old buildings so much? I mean, I think a lot of it is because everything you look at
has a story.
Has a story, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not this sort of cookie cutter thing where it doesn't have a relationship to its surroundings. It has relationships to its surroundings now because it's been around long enough that it influences the surroundings and vice versa.
Or the Apple products in the iPad, the program, the apps, they look like the analog object. You get a GarageBand and you play the guitar, right? It's an actual guitar.
Yeah.
It's and you could
they're bringing narrative back into
it. You could pluck the bass. Yeah. You could talk into this thing and it will respond to you, you know?
Yeah.
And
you're directly interacting with the rules of it. I mean, the great example being, and you see this on iPhones and so many other interfaces, well, what sort of rules do they follow in their interaction? They like to use physics. They really like to make it seem as though the interface you're interacting with has mass. You swipe your finger back and forth and you're applying a force to it. And you're accelerating it and then slowing it down. And it has friction, a little bit, not too much, but a bit of friction to it.
Just enough to make you think that it's like shifting your coffee cup from one end of the table to the other.
With a really cool slippery table.
Yeah. This is why maybe modernism has died. And it can only be valuable.
It's too simple.
It has to become. I remember that in the furniture, in the interior design show in downtown Toronto, I was watching people interact with the furniture. A lot of people were expecting drawers to open by touch. I was really.
That's really funny.
I mean, it might be, you know, convention. Maybe I haven't gone to these shows a lot, but that told me a lot about how people think about objects now, right?
Well, think how powerful it would be if you could go open a drawer by pushing on it slightly and it would just click out smoothly, come in, and you know, interacted with you.
Now people have developed this technology and are now selling such products, very expensive.
Yeah.
But they are on very recognizable wood and very recognizable forms, right?
Yeah.
So they have to be housed in a very simple way for the technology to be in the front and center. And that's why Jonathan Ive of Apple, the designer of these products, cares about how reflective the screen is, how the chrome feels. The rounded corners do say something. Like, he has to think about that because that's normal now.
Yeah.
And if you compare that, like a 12-year-old kid going into a gallery and seeing a panel with glue sticking out, that's bad. Like, it's a strange, like...
Well, it's bad because it breaks our set of rules about what you would expect from a high-quality object.
Well, because it's so ubiquitous and so invisible. Like, the idea, like making how things are made, which is how I understand what you mean, that objects have a history, is that human hands have touched them.
Or very cool, expensive machine hands have touched them.
Or they were cast. But a clay pot, prior to the mass production, is valuable because you could see some errors.
And back in its time, no one really cared that
yeah.
it had some errors and that it looked handmade.
It just had to...
That was meaningless.
It had to hold the your apples
yeah.
and your still life guy
yeah.
will paint that, right? But now it's the expectation of some kind of... I wouldn't call it perfection, but something that approximates it. Because I think what modernist forms as manifested in the iPad demonstrate is this is what perfect things look like.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know...
There's no seams.
There's this interesting, and I think, of course, very little known extreme to which this has been taken, which is actually in chips. And I don't just mean computer chips. I mean all the little bits of electronics with silicon in them. And they all tend to have this very small set of packages that they can be encased in. That is actual piece of plastic and metal that encapsulates the bit of silicon inside that does the magic. They all look the same. And you know, as an electronics designer, I work with this all the time. And I'm always specifying, figuring out what sort of chip I should use. But visually, the difference between a chip that costs $100 each and a chip that costs 20 cents each, you can't see it. It's what's inside.
Which you can't see, too.
Yeah,
it's so minuscule.
It's this modernism taken to the extreme.
That's amazing.
Now, the interesting question you can ask yourself is, well, do people collect computer chips? The answer is actually pretty damn obvious. No, they don't. With the exceptions of the oddball ones that are in different packages. No one's going to say, well, man, I tell you, that LM3X something or another, it was just so amazing. I mean, it was just the leader in op-amp design.
I give it...
And I think it's funny that, you know, as someone working in the industry, I can't think of the chip numbers off the top of my head. You know, there's the 555 timers, but they all look the same.
Well, let's give it 50 years. In 2060, somebody will have a collection of computer chips.
Oh, a few people do. Believe yeah. me. There are some.
Okay.
But it doesn't get a big following.
Yeah.
Precisely because visually it's not that interesting.
Well, that's what I was going to...
And it doesn't tell you the story of what's in it.
That's why maybe art, modernist art at least, minimalist art maybe, is dead. Because now when you go to a gallery, you're going to see cracks. You're going to see makeshift.
Well, IKEA killed it by creating all this great modernist stuff that you can get and have a nice, tasteful decor. People still want their nice, tasteful decors, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But they don't see that aesthetic as this groundbreaking piece of new art. It's just, well, I want a kitchen that looks nice. Oh, I'll go buy that thing out of the IKEA catalog. That was easy.
No, that's...
And there's nothing wrong with that.
That's another one. That's another...
Yeah.
Like, because like the... It's a flat... IKEA uses... I mean, IKEA is brilliant. It uses flat packs. It uses MDF. Really low-end wood, which is laminated.
And right? They make good enough products with it.
And I mean, you know, I know like 100 or more grad students who have lived on IKEA furniture, right? And most people do. But it kills the craft. Like there are still woodworkers who make their living out of making furniture. Like they're still furniture makers. But now what they have to do is bring in a new narrative angle into the furniture making.
Well, it killed the low end of the craft.
Yeah, that's true.
It killed the guys who couldn't market it.
Yeah.
There's still tons of high-end woodworking going on, but your day-to-day person doesn't want that. They just want a table.
So, Peter Todd, after all this amazing discussion, can you describe to me a typical Peter Todd day?
Usually I'm sitting at my desk working with Altium Designer.
Wait, you don't wake up?
No, I don't wake up. I'm always there 24 hours a day. No, I do the same things that the rest of you do. But then... But yeah, you know, like my day-to-day work thing really is going and designing schematics, going and taking the schematics and, or, and I should say a schematic for in electronics is the blueprint for how things connect together. So I'm either designing those blueprints, going and implementing those blueprints by drawing out where the actual parts will be on another piece of software, or I'm taking a physical thing that I've built according to those blueprints and figuring out why it didn't work. Usually figuring out why it didn't work. Very rarely why it did work. Usually they don't. Or, you know, like going and applying more rules, go analyze a new thing you could do, or all three at once. But it's just this constant iterative thing of making models, building something physical, trying to go validate if the physical thing matched the models, and then, you know, going in a circle again.
And practical science.
Yeah. What did I do when I was at OCAD making art? Well, I'd come up with models. I'd figure out how am I going to go make them into physical things. And then I'd go and try to sell them at galleries. Usually after testing them, see if they did what I thought they would. Again, it was just the same circular thing. And, you know, these days...
Without the suffering.
Something like that. I'm not sure which one is more suffering. But... you know, these days, what I do isn't that different from what I was doing in art, but there is a key thing. Who's the viewer? And because of the nature of the work I do, because it's sort of support equipment to other pieces of equipment, the only viewers really ends up being me. I'm the only one who sees my designs. And I'm happy with this.
How come?
I enjoyed the making of, the designing. I did enjoy having stuff in galleries, but I can live without that.
So what are you going to do now as an engineer? What's going to happen to art?
Well, you know, I should also say on top of the engineering, I'm trying to go do a physics degree at U of T, which has even less viewers to the work I do. Maybe my TAs when they mark my papers or something, but it is for most part me. And it seems to me for, you know, I mean, of course, there's also practical considerations of, well, how much time in a day do I have? You know, I fill it up pretty well trying to complete another degree and work at a startup at the same time.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, it's fairly laid back startup. They've been around for years. It's been a long-term project, but, you know.
Hence the day. How many hours a day do you work?
12 to 16.
Okay. Good.
But not hard work, you know, just sort of lazing about.
Yeah.
You didn't hear this, right, boss? But, you know, eventually at some point, though, I will have free time. And then I got to decide, well, what am I going to do? I mean, maybe I'll start exploring some art again. Maybe I'll do it before then. But I don't know. What is probably true, though, is that the sort of art that I'll do will, again, continue to be about rules. Will continue to be about exploring things technologically. And... big difference is, well, next time when I'm creating art again, I'll have this much bigger set of rules to draw upon. I'll have a whole physics degree. I'll have a ton of experience with electronics. And all this is going to influence the way I do things.
There you have it. Stay tuned for Chroma Radio's next episode with architect and artist Tom Noe. Thanks for listening.